Hello there, and welcome to the Coming of Age Stories podcast and our December episode for the year. It is the holiday season, and I will say right now, I'm not big into Christmas. I love my time off, I love the summer, I love the food, but the holiday itself is not really my thing. I am, however, fascinated by the seemingly endless list of traditions that come along with it, the ones that have lasted hundreds, if not thousands of years, and the ones that have only just popped up, the ones that are synonymous with the holiday for seemingly everyone, and the ones that are purely something one family does. One of the most interesting things to me when researching my Santa episode a couple of years back was to see how the myth evolved over time and came together to make this story and concept that so many people have just kind of agreed upon. Yes, many details vary from culture to culture, but, you know, the coal, the outfit, the sack, the reindeer, it's just the way things are. It's just how the story goes. That's why my topic for today provides such an interesting counterpoint or companion piece to that. Rather than developing from a real-life man who lived in the year 270, this quote-unquote tradition dates back to 2005? I'm talking about Elf on the Shelf. Now, I am going to acknowledge my bias right up front. I'm not a fan of this thing. I went into my research not being a fan of this thing. That being said, I have no desire, and now that I've done all my research, still have no desire, to take anything away from anyone that can provide a sense of joy, fun, and spark imagination in children. But I did want to dig into the history of this tradition and find out about its potential impact. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about its origin and then look at whether or not this thing is deemed to actually be good for kids. Spoiler alert, I am not the only one who didn't like this. People have opinions. Thank you so much for tuning in. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe if you like what I'm doing here, as that really helps other people find the show, as does simply telling people about it. The podcast is also on Instagram and Facebook at Coming of Agecast. Additionally, if you'd like to support the show financially, you can do that on my Patreon page. This month, you get not just one bonus episode, but five. I'm releasing audio of me reading A Christmas Carol, a chapter at a time, every day this week until Christmas Eve. A link to sign up to that is in the description of this episode. Let's get on with things now, shall we? Christmas traditions, they can vary in their scale and their scope. Most people will put up a tree, put their presents under it. Some people hang stockings. We have the houses who go all out on the lights and front lawn displays. In the last few years, I've noticed that thing of buying Christmas pyjamas and taking a family photo. Peter Alexander, really onto a winner with that one. Then there is the little things that might vary from family to family. Like when I was little, my mum used to let me open one present on Christmas Eve. I also used to put a pillowcase at the end of the bed for presents to appear from the Christmas angels. I was told about Christmas angels instead of Santa, since I was straight up terrified of Santa. I know some families might have a traditional meal or game they play every year. It's always interesting to think about where these rituals come from. The more universal ones can generally be traced back to years of social evolution. Stockings, for example, can be dated back to the famous poem A Visit from St. Nicholas, more commonly known as The Night Before Christmas, and seemingly comes from one of the old St. Nicholas stories of him leaving coins in the socks of a poor family. And then there's the individual traditions that also can develop naturally from your family dynamic or just the way your household likes to do things. This year is my first Christmas living with my partner, and it's genuinely been really fun to talk about what the holiday in our home together looks like, each bringing things from our own upbringings, our childhoods, as well as coming up with the practices that just belong to us. Elf on the Shelf is interesting to me because it is something that started as the latter, a unique way of doing things for one particular family that has then been packaged, marketed, and sold as a universal tradition. For those unfamiliar, The Elf on the Shelf began as a picture book written by Caro Aubersold with her daughter, Chanda Bell, and illustrated by Co. Steinhardt. I sincerely apologise if I'm saying those names incorrectly. The foreword from Carol explains that it was a concept that evolved from her own childhood and became something much bigger when she had her own daughters, Chanda and Krista. Here's the premise of the book and the custom itself. So we all know Santa can tell who's been naughty and who's been nice, but the book posits we've never really known how he could do that. Turns out he has millions of so-called scout elves who are sent to every home in order to monitor and then tell Santa what's going on. The exact line from the book is, "I watch and report on all that you do." The book asks the children to give the elf a name and then explains that every night, through magic, the elf flies back to the North Pole to let Santa know how the child behaved that day. The book goes on, "I tell him if you've been good or bad. The news of the day makes him happy or sad. A push or a shove, a report to the boss. But small acts of kindness will not be a loss. In the car or at the park or even at school, the word will get out if you broke a rule." I was really, really trying to keep the snark out of my voice while I was reading that. So part of the fun is this whole thing is that every morning the elf returns and is in a different place. So when the children wake up, it's a game to try and find where it is. The book also explains there's a couple of rules. You can't touch the elf, for example, or the magic will disappear and the elf cannot talk to you. And if its magic disappears, well then, who will tell Santa if you've been good or not? But you can talk to the elf and tell it everything you want. The book goes on to say, "The final decision with Santa now rests. What do you think? Will you get your request? The night before Christmas, my job's at an end. The rest of the year with Santa I'll spend." And the elf goes back to the North Pole until next Christmas. And the book, of course, comes with a little toy elf in order to put this practice into action. So, this was something that Carol did with her daughters, Chanda and Krista, along with their brother Brandon, growing up in Georgia in the 70s. The girls describe it in this way in an interview with the Huffington Post. "We had an elf growing up for as long as we can remember. Our elf was named Fisbee, and Fisbee, of course, would report to Santa Claus at night and be back in a different position in our house the next day. We loved it. It was a chance for us to tell Santa directly what we might want for Christmas or to do good deeds so that Santa would know about them." This article, titled "The Strange and Sweet History of the Elf on the Shelf," goes on to say, "When Arbuthnot was a child herself, Fisbee was more like an ornament that stayed on the Christmas tree and didn't move. But the tradition morphed over time, and when she became a mother, she told her kids the elf would magically fly around at night and mustn't be touched or it would lose its magic, likely to protect it because we were pretty rambunctious children." That's a line from Krista Pitts. "The idea of a magical elf that flies to the North Pole at night and reappears in a surprise location was super fun and whimsical to the twins and their brother, Brandon," Pitts recalled. "It had all of us racing out of bed in the morning to find our elf." Honestly, sounds really cute and lovely. And it apparently wasn't until the children grew up and went to college that they realised this wasn't something that every family did. So, how does this go from one quirky family's tradition to a global bestseller and social media sensation? The Strange and Sweet History of Elf on the Shelf describes a time of hardship for the family, once the kids were adults. Chanda had recently left her job to be a stay-at-home mother and spend more time in the family home, and Carol was struggling with empty nest syndrome and some medical issues. Chanda suggested they turn their little childhood game into a story, a project for them to work on together. Once it was finished, they looked for publishers, but it was continuously rejected. So they decided to self-publish it. And this was when Chanda's twin, Krista, came on board and evidently left her job at a home shopping network and sold her house in order to finance the project. Chanda maxed out all her credit cards and Arbuthnot used her retirement savings. The three of them started their own publishing house, Creative Classic Activities and Books. Their initial run of the book was 5,000 copies. Honestly, it's a pretty phenomenal story. Elf on the Shelf, of course, did not become a craze overnight. The three women took the book to markets, trade shows, bookstores, and online. By 2007, the Today Show in America was running a segment on the book, following Jennifer Garner being spotted with the box in New York. And it just exploded from there. In October 2022, Today reported that more than 17.5 million Scout Elves had been adopted globally. The elf features in the Thanksgiving Day Parade, there's been an animated special, licensed clothing, and of course several spin-off books and other products. the company now has over 80 employees. The Telegraph reported in 2021 that about a quarter of American families now use Elf on the Shelf as part of their Christmas celebrations. We do not have publicly available records on the worth of it all, but to quote the Telegraph, Fortune reported that the year-on-year growth has averaged at 149%, with sales hitting $16.6 million in 2011. Yeah, I gotta write me a Christmas book. The rise in popularity of the story and the toy also came with a new element that is probably what people now are most familiar with. The fact that each day the elf appears not only in a different place, but with a different activity, joke, or game for the children. This is what you might have seen on social media, and Pinterest is littered with posts giving families idea of what to do with their elf each day. Sometimes they appear with letters, poems, speech bubbles. They might be posing with other toys. They might come with an activity like a Christmas craft or a recipe. Or they might just be in a wacky place. They might be hanging from the chandelier, riding down the stairs in a sled made of candy canes, fishing for Swedish fish in the bathroom sink. A quick Google search reveals a myriad of pretty spectacular creativity by grown-ups across the globe. What's interesting is this part does not really feature in the original story, nor really encouraged by the creators. Perhaps this is because it is the source of some of the criticism of the elf, which we will get into thoroughly soon. The elf's daily shenanigans are perfect for Instagram content, and with that comes the pressure for all families to match up to each other's efforts. Carol, Chanda, and Krista emphasise the importance of making the elf a part of your traditions in a way that works for you and shouldn't require any over-the-top efforts, a lot of time, or too much money. This is the age of the aesthetic, though, and the Elf on the Shelf posts, lengthy blogs full of ideas, and countless Pinterest pages aren't going away anytime soon. This creative part of it has really taken a life of its own and is one of the things that is celebrated about the Elf on the Shelf tradition. There's an argument that it allows the grown-ups to get in on the fun of Christmas and show off their imagination and also appreciate the joy in their children when they experience the newest elf adventure every day. It is every day, though, and I am sure that there are countless families who find the expectation of something bigger and better on a daily basis exhausting, if not borderline impossible. An article by Jeffrey Kloss, published in Medium, describes his own experiences with it. He writes, "Don't get me wrong, I like Christmas, but this elf has become a job. Luckily my wife does the heavy lifting, but I hear this from our kids often. Didn't the elf do this last year? There are only so many original things you can come up with on your own. Lucky for us, Pinterest and Facebook are rife with ideas you can swipe." And this is just the beginning of some of the critiques our little elf scout friend has. Back in 2012, Kate Tuttle wrote an article for The Atlantic titled, "You're a Creepy One, Elf on the Shelf." In it, she outlines her concerns about the concept, and she really doesn't mince her words. Tuttle describes the elf as a marketing juggernaut dressed up as a tradition. And while she acknowledges most traditions are human-made, because of course they are, she describes the Elf on the Shelf juggernaut as being uniquely fake. Comparing it to other more modern practices, like watching Love Actually every year, Tuttle says, "They worm their way into our hearts becoming holiday traditions, rather than bowling us over with strident demands." She is also critical of the quality of the book itself, and on this point, I have to agree, it's not particularly well-written or illustrated. Though I wonder if its homemade feel has been a part of what has contributed to its success. It doesn't feel like a slick marketing ploy to sell tiny cutesy elf dolls, the design of which, as some have pointed out, is remarkably similar to knee-hugger elves that were popular in the 50s and 60s. It feels like something that was cobbled together in the garage by a bunch of mums, and I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. Nothing in the interviews from the creators indicates any kind of sinister plot to make millions, and to take their story at face value means this was a family who just wanted something from their childhood that brought them a lot of joy to be shared. There's a more cynical take, of course, and Kate Tuttle clearly has that. By adding the subtitle "A Christmas Tradition," the book is selling itself not just as a cute concept, but something to really take on. Like the myth of Santa himself, the extensive popularity of these scout elves can add this pressure to families to take it on themselves or risk their children missing out. Everybody else has them, why don't we? As Tuttle says, there's a demanding aspect to it rather than something that's just naturally growing. Tuttle also criticizes the elf for contributing to the Christmas creep, as the official scouting season is meant to kick off at the end of November. In this, she again touches on that pressure the elf can add to families. She writes, "The elf drives mothers crazy. In places where nearly every family boasts an arms race occurs, egged on by kids bringing home stories of what their classmates' elves are up to. Part of the elf legend is that the elf returns each night to the North Pole to tell Santa what's going on in the household where he lives. Each morning he returns, landing in a different spot. But it's not enough in some neighbourhoods just to move the elf each night while the kids sleep. Mothers buy and wrap gifts for the elf to distribute, bake cookies, write little notes. Not that some of them aren't into it, as this Pinterest board demonstrates, but is it any wonder that this kind of holiday madness, which dovetails with every strain of guilt mothers feel over their domestic imperfections, coupled with the catch-22 that if you do your job right, your child will never thank you for it, because all the goodies come from the elf." These complaints are interesting, and they are well documented in numerous articles I read as research for this episode. The holiday season is not really the time to add extra obligations, pressure, or stress onto families, and Elf on the Shelf can easily do just that. But there are other concerns that people have about the concept, and they get even more sinister, with many experts expressing doubts of the benefits. Here's where my research, honestly, started getting a little overwhelming. You Google, "Is Elf on the Shelf good?" and a staggering number of editorials, blogs, and think pieces pop up, and the vast majority of them are negative. Here's a sample of some headlines. "Pros and cons of Elf on the Shelf." "Why I hate Elf on the Shelf," from Happy Family. "Why the Elf on the Shelf is banned from my home," from the Sydney Morning Herald. "Elf on the Shelf is actually pretty bad for your kids," from Her Family. "Three honest to mom reasons to not do Elf on the Shelf," from Columbia Mom. I just had to say mom in the American accent that it's written with, sorry. Okay, now I know how the blogosphere works. Contrarian opinions are clickbait and likely to be read and shared, especially when dealing with something as popular as this phenomenon. But if there's anything I know about well-intentioned parents and people who are raising children, is that they are constantly trying to do the right thing by their kids. And I can only imagine how scary it is to try and decide if this thing is a little bit of magic and happiness, or if it's, as this headline from The Guardian puts it, "Elf on the Shelf is a fun and festive way to teach your children to submit to the surveillance state." I don't want to be a huge Debbie Downer here, nor a harbinger of doom. I want to outline some of the biggest concerns experts, psychologists, and parents have, but I'm not confident I'm going to be able to present any solid conclusions. Just like my deep dive into Santa Claus, there's no hard evidence that these sort of quote-unquote lies cause serious and lasting damage to children. There's not really substantial evidence of anything much at this point. But it is hard to ignore some of the more damning criticisms which call out the concept of scout elves for being not only deceptive, but manipulative. And here's where I'll say that while I have admitted I am not a fan, and I share a lot of these concerns and went into this episode with a reasonable amount of my own bias and kind of looking for stuff to confirm it, the level of vitriol in a lot of the pieces I read was quite intense. Again, hardline takes get views, but I do think people, and particularly parents, get really fired up about this. And the comment sections, in response to a lot of these hardline takes, are even more passionate and defensive of it. So, I've already discussed the concern that the elf adds stress to families at an already hectic time, and social media can escalate that and perhaps even make the focus to be on the aesthetic rather than the initial fun concept. So, let's dig into some other criticisms. One of them taps into the concern about Santa himself, and asks whether teaching children to behave appropriately should be more nuanced than the categories naughty and nice. Moreover, should their good behaviour be prompted by an inherent desire to be a good person or because of the promise of presents? This is not a new question, but bringing the supposed messenger of Father Christmas into your home with the claim that everything you do is reported back makes it a much clearer directive to children. Petula Dvorak wrote in her article for the Washington Post, "It's a Faustian deal. First, you get this amazing disciplinary tool. My little heathens instantly turn into angels the moment I said the elf is watching. Not like the abstract Santa is watching. This was a real actual thing, staring down at them with dead eyes, perched on the curtain rod, then the bookshelf, then swinging from the chandelier. I'm beginning to feel withdrawal come January." One of the only pieces I read, to quote a child psychologist, US child psychologist Dr. Vanessa LaPointe, had this to say. This quote is a little long, but I think it's worth exploring. "Parents have been trying frantically to control their child's behaviour by making some kind of positive outcome contingent on good behaviour," LaPointe explains. "Be good, and you get a star on the star chart. Be good, and Santa will bring you a present. The problem is that this creates fallout emotionally and neurologically." LaPointe explains that contrary to popular belief, good behaviour is not something that can be conned. When adults get up to tricks and strategies to try and control children's behaviour, two not-so-great things happen. The first is that the child intuitively senses in the adult a struggle to control, which must mean that the adult doesn't really have it going on. A capable, competent, in-charge adult wouldn't need to rely on tricks and strategies to control the child. The second is that the child feels played by the adult. The problem, the expert explains, is that this can create a sense of disconnect between the children and adults. Scientifically, we know that a child's most essential need for healthy development is a deep and trusting relationship with their parents, says LaPointe. So this is not something we should mess around with. It is interesting to me that a lot of the writing I came across was from passionate opinions from concerned parents and did not necessarily have this kind of evidence or support from experts. Doing more research into what psychologists specifically do say, and most of them have similar concerns. Kara Goodwin in Psychology Today supports the idea that using the elf as motivation for good behaviour does not work. She writes, "Research finds that tangible rewards, such as presents, that are expected, that is, promised in advance, are not linked to performance, as is often the case for Christmas presents, and are linked with decreased intrinsic or internally driven motivation. That means that even if the promise of Christmas presents resulted in improved behaviour for the month of December, children will be less likely to continue to choose to behave in this way after the promise of Christmas presents is removed. Put even more simply, your child could become more likely to misbehave after Christmas is over if you use this strategy." The idea that rewards don't lead to longer lasting changes in behaviour is true and supported by psychology. All that being said, parents are humans, and parenting is hard, and being able to just sometimes say, "Stop it, the elf is watching," might be something an exhausted human adult just needs to be able to do sometimes. And all of this is connected to additional concerns, again, one that is shared with the Santa Claus story, that is, effectively, is it okay to lie to your children? This was my exploration in my Santa Claus episode. Is it a fun and magic lie, or just still a lie? And as is the case with Santa, the answer is yes, but maybe that's okay, sort of, we don't really know. There doesn't seem to be any psychological evidence that telling your children about Santa has this major negative impact on them, even if the day they find out the truth might be difficult and devastating. The elf seems to be the same. In fact, there are lots of anecdotal stories from adults recalling so-called deceptive things their parents did, like making fairy gardens in their backyard or putting Easter bunny footprints out on the lawn. These stories are told fondly, acknowledging the effort that so many families put into creating a sense of magic and wonder for their children. The most staunch defenders of the elf talk about how happy the children are looking for it every morning and how it creates something really special in the holiday season. And like with Santa, most children naturally just grow out of it, finding the logical inconsistencies where their minds are ready to, and can often let go of it with their own accord, asking their parents, "Hey, is this all really real?" One of the most vicious attacks of the elf, I read, really went after the lie aspect of it all, but I'm going to be honest, I did not align very well with the ultimate message of this piece and tone of this guy. It was honestly so borderline ludicrous that I have to share at least a little bit of it. David Carl Johnson wrote, "Let's bench the elf on the shelf for psychology today." And his argument for it seems to come down to, if we lie about Santa and the elf, our kids will stop believing in God. I'm not exaggerating. Here's what he has to say. Your children rely on you to give them accurate information about the way the world is, and you should want them to trust and believe what you say. But finding out that you've been lying to them, and even playing an elaborate joke on them, for example, by moving the elf yourself by telling them it moves on its own, has the possibility of significantly eroding their ability to trust you. What else might you be lying about or tricking them into believing? Think it's not a big deal? In some stories I've collected, children come to doubt God's existence after learning the truth about Santa. If mum and dad are lying about Santa, they're probably lying about God too. This is actually fairly good reasoning. Have you ever thought about how many characteristics the two characters share? What an amazing leap! What's even more incredible is he goes on to criticise the elf for encouraging gullibility and credulity in children, that they shouldn't develop critical thinking, but merely believe what their parents say just because. And I think there's another little connection to children being raised to believe in God too. The fact is, adults lie to children. Of course we do. It's silly to pretend we don't. But I also understand families not wanting to be dishonest to this extent. That being said, the ones who do choose to tell their kids about the elf, the tooth fairy, the Easter bunny, fairies, mermaids, whatever else might take their fancy, there's not a lot to suggest there's anything inherently objectively wrong with this. When the lie involves shame, fear, that's where some of the problematic elements really come into it. Threatening a child who's misbehaving that the elf will tell Santa to leave coal in their stocking, or using the elf in general as a disciplinary scapegoat, does not seem like the best idea. Some of the articles I read pointed to the potential damage to the parental relationship, and the fact that behavioural change through these sorts of tactics not only isn't lasting, but potentially quite damaging. And this is where we come to the biggest condemnation of the elf on the shelf. You've heard it alluded to in a few of the headlines I read before, and it's really the culmination of all of this. Does the elf on the shelf normalise an invasion of privacy and make children okay with the concept of being spied and reported on? It's the next level of the lie, isn't it? Alex Steed wrote for the Bangor News Daily, "Having been moulded by this age of NSA overreach, Snowden, WikiLeaks and Anonymous, what bothers me most is that inviting Elf on the Shelf into the home unnecessarily extends surveillance culture into a place that should be free of it. Santa Claus is a myth that at best represents generosity at its finest, but with the elf, we choose to emphasise his surveillance. That is really weird." The New York Times explored this angle in depth, speaking to privacy organisations and other relevant parties. I quote, "I know a lot of families just see this as a fun thing, but it's worth thinking about the messages it's giving to children about surveillance by authority," said Jay Stanley, senior policy and analyst at the ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project. "Personally, I consider success as a parent to be teaching my kids to do the right thing even when nobody is watching, whether they be from the North Pole or anywhere else." The article goes on to quote a number of other experts who express concern for children not feeling like they have a safe space that is entirely private. Mr. Khan of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project is quoted in this New York Times article and said children should be taught that no one should be looking at you in your bedroom without consent. "There is a cost to normalising surveillance," he said, "even in the most adorable ways." In the article for The Guardian, whose headline I quoted before, "Elf on the Shelf is a fun and festive way to teach your child to submit to the surveillance state," Matt Beard writes extensively of the potential harm this concept could be causing. He talks to experts who similarly discuss the importance of children developing a sense of independence, agency, and self-determination, arguing that allowing children to grow up with the idea of someone watching them to ensure they behave can stifle their development. Beard really does delve into the moral philosophy of it all, making reference to the panopticon. He also uses the word that pops up in a lot of these critical pieces. Creepy. That is ultimately how a lot of people feel about the elf. He is creepy, and people are uncomfortable with inviting this little spy, excuse me, scout, into their homes. Caitlin Fitzsimmons wrote for the Sydney Morning Herald, "The idea of having a doll in your house that spies on you and rewards you with presents seems like a great way to prime our future citizens to accept ubiquitous surveillance and focus on being good little consumers." Good Lord, people hate this thing, which I did not expect when I started this. I knew I had similar feelings and there would be likely pieces that confirmed and agreed with that, but there are opinion articles where the writers talk with aggression about how much they hate it, to the point where Petula Dvorak, whose Washington Post article I quoted before, interviewed Krista Pitts and told her to her face she has dreamed of killing her. Part of me wonders, as someone who thinks the pressure, the lying, the spying is a genuine cause for concern, that the level of hatred also stems from the fact that this thing is so goddamn popular. There is a common thread, next to the word creepy, that addresses how people feel this thing is being shoved down their throats. "This is a thing we all do," the book shouts. People hate that and have a real attachment to their own holiday customs and having them feel personal and hard won. In response to Dvorak, Pitts is quoted as saying, "I just don't understand this negativity. I find this notion of keeping up with the Joneses so negative. You don't have to be the Griswolds. The elves take on the personality of the family that adopts it," she cheerily explains. "If you're a family that's full of creative people and your elf enjoys doing creative things at night, that's your tradition." The less negative explorations of the elf focus on this part of it, but often take a bit of a pros and cons approach. Pro, it's a sweet way to make Christmas memories with your family. Con, it can be a huge hassle. Pro, it can help with children's behaviour at a difficult time. Con, that help might not be lasting. Pro, it can foster imagination and creativity. Con, it can make your children be used to being spied on. If it sounds like I'm going around in circles, it's because I really have been. I went into all this, I will acknowledge, looking for support for my own gut feelings about it. And I agree with pretty much every criticism I've laid out here, except for the one about it leading kids to stop believing in God. I agree that this book is poorly written. It marketing itself as a tradition forces an expectation and is cloying in its presentation. The Instagrammable nature of it absolutely can create undue pressure, particularly on families who are at their most stressed during the holiday season, that comes with plenty of its own obligations without us adding to it. It can introduce an element of deception and manipulation into behaviour management and potentially make young people comfortable with the idea of being monitored. And it is all just freaking creepy. Those things are all true for me. But you know what? I don't think there's a clear answer here. I read an anecdote from one family who uses the elf in their own way. He's not a scout or a spy and doesn't report anything to Santa. He's just a decoration that comes out every year and the kids love him. I've seen some of the creative things my friends have done with their elves, the puns, the games, the presents, the poses they end up in, and I often find them delightful. The interviews with the families that started it all, they come off as genuine in their motivation to share this thing that was special to them and seem genuinely baffled at the negative response. Backlash is inevitable as soon as something gets genuinely popular, especially when it's connected to Christmas, a holiday that, even though it's widespread, feels deeply personal to so many. So I don't have a clear conclusion here. There's no evidence about the impact of it, only other psychological theories that can be connected to it, like the impact of reinforcement and punishment. I did see a tweet the other day that said it'll be interesting to hear from the Elf and the Shelf kids in 10 years. And it will be. Some of them will probably have fond memories of the elaborate things their parents used to do and feel grateful for such Christmas magic. Some might feel betrayed and manipulated. And some might be weirdly okay with it when we welcome the concept of Big Brother into our homes. I think the underlying thing is that every family has to do what makes sense for you and what brings happiness during the season. Don't do something because social media has made you feel like you have to, but don't not do it because you're terrified you're going to irrevocably screw up your kid. Does it still feel kind of like a scam to me? Yeah, but sort of in the way astrology does, as long as you take it with a grain of salt, let it give you the joy that it can, and ignore the parts that don't. And that's my take for now. I'm sure I'll keep thinking about it over the holiday. With that, I wish you all the best, whatever and however you celebrate this time of year. As for me, I've got my Lego advent calendar, my Disney decorations, and lights on the front lawn trees. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to check out my Patreon, where you can hear me read the entirety of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, if that's something you're into. For now, you'll hear from me next month.